Hello. How are you doing?
Fine.
Welcome to Sweden, James. That was good Swedish. These are Swedes being very, very happy.
Okay.
So, welcome to Epicenter. How many of you have been here before? Cool. For the uninitiated, 30-second shameless plug. Epicenter is a house of innovation. We work with some of the largest companies working with corporate innovation, so SCB and Chalu and lots of others that sit in our ecosystem. We're also the home for fast-growing digital companies. So in the house sits Twitter and Yahoo and world's largest MMO for girls that plays horse riding. So it's called World of Horsecraft. If you know World of Warcraft, they call it World of Horsecraft. So it's a fun environment. I'm biased, of course, but it's a fun environment, a lot of interesting people. And every week we have something called Thought Leader Sessions that we do together at Singularity University, which is a collaboration between Google and NASA. And as part of that, we get amazing people. And today we got a friend from Microsoft in Sweden saying, we have a tech luminary coming to Sweden. And when you Google the luminary, you realize he's truly a luminary. How many of you have heard of James Whittaker before? Cool. You've got a friendly audience. So James Whittaker, for the 30-second introduction, started off in FBI in the 80s, but was too alternative and left the government quite early on. Today he's the evangelist at Microsoft. Before that you were at Google, before you realized that Google is sort of taking away our souls, and moved on to Microsoft, and believes a lot in technology and the future. And today he's going to take us in a journey that we call uncomfortably exciting, where we will look at how technology is changing the face of humanity in both good and interesting dimensions. I've been sort of ODing on James Whittaker as soon as I heard his name the last few weeks. And I'm very excited to see you live today and in our home territory. Thank you very much, James, and take it away.
Thank you. Now, let's be nice to Google. They're not taking away our souls. They're just making money on them. It's that simple, right? This is what Americans do. I want to ask and answer a question today. What's next? Do you ever ask yourself this question? Because if you can answer it, you get ahead of the future. If you can answer it, you're in a position to invent the future. If you can answer it, you're in a position to lead others into the future. If you can't, then you're doomed to chase the future for at least 10 years. And 10 years, I say that for a reason, and I'll talk about that. So that's what we're going to talk about. And in order to understand the future, you have to understand that the future is a disruption of the present. The present is a disruption of the past. And if you understand the disruptions that have occurred in the past, you know how we got to where we are today. And that just might inform where we'll be tomorrow. So that's what I want to talk about. There have been three disruptions in the past, three that we can talk about, three that we can pick apart and understand why they happened. Understand how those disruptions were used to create the future. Three of them. Now the cool thing is that the industry is undergoing one right now, this year and next year. The decisions that we make, the companies that make the right decisions are going to be the ones creating the future. Companies that make the wrong decisions are going to be the ones chasing it. So let's talk about the three disruptions of the past and understand what happened. So the first one occurred in the late 1980s. And in the 1980s, we were all programming mainframe computers. We would sit behind our dumb terminals that had nothing to do except connect to that central mainframe and send information back and forth. Now, as a software developer, this was a painful experience. As a software developer, you had to wait to get your code compiled until it got up there and stood in line with all the other jobs, finally got to compile, and then it would come back in and say, of course, your code couldn't compile, and you had this constant loop. In order to invent anything, you had a mainframe in your way. A PC came along. Now this is important because understand that developers in all of these disruptions, developers have come first. Developers, software developers are the first ones to the future every single time. When the PC came out, us software developers looked at it and said, we want this. We had a powerful computer right under our desk. We could set up our programming environment any way we want. We could compile and compile. We could get our stuff right before it went out and got deployed. We liked that. And this is our first hint about the future. If you remove developer pain, developers will flock to your platform. And when developers flock to your platform, they invent shit. They innovate. They make things that people want. And so the second people, the users come along behind them. It's developers first, innovation second, users chase the innovation. And then, of course, it happened again. So Microsoft won this era, and then another disruption came. Look, if you programmed a computer in the 80s, you did it on an IBM mainframe. If you programmed a computer in the 90s, you did it in Windows. And then all of a sudden, the web comes, and the web changes the game. See, we don't get to pick the change, but we do get to make the new thing a platform that draws developers. And that's exactly what it did. In the 1990s, your code was locked on a single computer. You didn't really know who your user was. You didn't know what the users were doing on that computer. And you didn't know how to change things. If you had bugs, you had to wait. They had to buy a new version and you ship them disks. That's pain. Developer pain. The web came along and changed that. I knew who my user was. I could watch them. I could see what part of the app that they were using. I could change it. If there was a bug, I could fix it in place. All they had to do is refresh their browser, and they had all my bug fixes. The removal of pain, once again, that caused developers to flee the desktop and write code for the web. And if you coded in the 2000s, you coded for the web. You wrote HTML, you wrote JavaScript, you wrote CSS. And the web took over because it removed developer pain. Developers flocked to the platform, developers innovated, and the users followed. You couldn't get Amazon.com on the desktop. You couldn't get eBay.com on the desktop. You got it in the web. All of a sudden, the desktop was a way to get to the web. So Google won this era. And guess what? The third disruption came along and knocked Google off their perch. I remember I was a Google employee in 2009 when this happened, when we understood that somebody moved the cheese. Steve Jobs moved the cheese. How'd he do it? What happened? Understand that at the time, wait, let's step back for a second and look at this 10-year pattern. PCs were 10 years old before they became really important. The web was 10 years old before it became really important, right? Invented in 1989, became really important in 1999. And all of a sudden, smartphones become important. 1997, the Palm Pilot debuts. 2007, the iPhone makes the platform meaningful. And look what it did for developers. It removed pain. How did you write a smartphone? If you had a smartphone app in before 2007 when the iPhone came out, how did you get it on someone's phone? They had it, you put it on a website, they would go to the website with their phone plugged into their PC, find it and download it onto their phone, right? You had to know where it was, www.whereinthefuckisthatapp.com, right? You had to know that. We're in Sweden, this is okay. Seems to be actually preferred. And the download process was different for every single one. The configuration process was different for every single one. Along comes Steve Jobs and says, look, I'm gonna put them all in the store. They're all gonna be the same. The download process is the same. You're not gonna have to worry about all that. You're gonna be able to write these cool mobile apps and people will be able to find it. People will be able to install it. People will be able to use it. And we did things. No one wanted to code an Objective-C, but we did it because it removed the pain of all that installation and all that configuration. And all of a sudden, we're all using this again. And so now we get to the point of the 2000s, right? Here we have another 10-year-old technology that's beginning to cause developers pain. So let's talk about that pain, because it's in that pain where we find the answer. And if we can discover the developer's pain points today, that's going to point to the future. Because if you can come in and remove that pain, developers are going to flock to your platform. So let's talk about this future, and then we'll talk about the pain. And I'll tell you what, when you talk about the future, you really have to talk about zombies, don't you? Because zombies are the future. You all understand that, right? Not like, remember that bullshit vampire stuff they tried to sell us a few years ago? totally made up. We went to see the movies because the vampires were kind of sexy, but that's made up. That's never going to happen. Zombies are going to happen. Right? We can mathematically describe the virus. We have this virus in the lab. We're creating zombie mice right now. It's just a matter of time. So when you talk about the future, you got to talk about the zombie apocalypse. Now, this is my favorite zombie movie because not only does it have zombies in it, it's got Brad Pitt in it. This is like zombie movie meets date night, and it's perfect. And there I was at this movie with my date when something very strange happens. She had been looking forward to this movie all day long. She heard about the shirtless scene, Brad. Oh, she's going to see Brad. Brad, naked Brad Pitt. What could be better than that? Well, something was better than that because halfway through the movie, my date pulls out a phone and begins to share screen time. Like, oh, Brad Pitt, something on my phone. Oh, Brad Pitt, something on my phone. And guess what? I don't know if she was just weird or what, but whatever was on the phone won. She was staring at her screen and walked out of the movie theater and left me alone with zombies and Brad Pitt. All I could think was, Brad, keep your shirt on. I do not want to have to tell her she missed it. I don't want to have to describe the magnificence of your text to my date. I don't want to have to do that. Well, she comes back a few minutes later, kind of huffing in, and sits down, right? And I'm waiting for her to say it, waiting for her to say it. What do you say when you've missed part of a movie? You come back, you turn to the person you're with, and you say, what did I miss, right? And she never said it. She just kept started watching the movie like nothing happened. Crazy. And so I turned to her and I said, hey, you didn't miss anything. And she said, yeah, I know. Because she has an app that tells her when to pee at the movies. There is an app for that. Somebody has watched every single movie on the planet. They've curated it all and uploaded it to the cloud. Oh, here's the action scene. Don't pee during this. There's a new character introduced. Brad Pitt first appears. Don't pee. But then there's 4 minutes right here in the middle. Nothing really happens. Go take a leak. Isn't this crazy? So do you all go to movies? Just raise your hand if you're all moviegoers. I think it's safe to say we all go to movies, right? How many of you all have this app? No one. Guess what we just found, people? Developer pain. Here's three people, two women and a man, who wrote this app and put all the data constantly in about the new movies. They charge 99 cents for it. And guess how much money they made in a room full of 150 people? Nothing. That's pain. All of a sudden, the App Store, which was a savior back in 2007, is causing developers pain because no one can find your app. There's too many apps there. They have a discoverability problem. So, what do we do for developers to remove this pain? You answer that question, and you've just invented the future. So let's talk about the technology that's going to be involved. What's 10 years old? The PC, 10 years old before it became relevant. The web, 10 years old before it became relevant. The smartphone, 10 years old before it became relevant. What's 10 years old? Several things are 10 years old right now. This year, the cloud, thanks to Amazon, is 10 years old. AWS, born in 2006. The Internet of Things, about 10 years old. Virtual reality, about 10 years old. So let's take these things and see if we can cast this scenario into the future. And this is what I want you to do. This is your homework. I want you to take the scenarios that you and you're trying to implement now, that your customers are dealing with now. Take those scenarios and cast them into this future of big data, the cloud, machine learning, Internet of Things, and virtual reality. So let's do this. So let's go back in time. Let's go back to our movie. And here I am watching, remember we're in the future now, watching a movie, watching, oh, Brad Pitt and zombies, this is great. And then halfway through the movie, you realize, oh, man. Oh, I got it. Oh, and just then, there's a little vibration on your watch or whatever, and it's your tech telling you, your personal assistant, oh, I don't know, maybe Cortana, telling you, you got to go, don't you? How did she know? She knows I've got to go. How does she know? Because in the future, my tech goes everywhere with me, and it can geolocate me in a toilet. And the last time Cortana geolocated me in a toilet was 2.5 hours ago. And Cortana's been watching my mean time to bladder evacuation, about 2.5 hours. My tech knows I've got to go before I do. And my tech is prepared. She's like, don't worry, don't worry. In 2 minutes, there's a 4-minute pee window. Wait a minute, how did she know? How did she know? Because she knows where I am. She can geolocate me. My tech can do that right now. Lat long pair. Look up the lat long pair. Convert it to an address. Easy to do. It's an API call. Now I know you're at and Google, Bing, we both have entity databases. We can tell you you're in a movie theater. But in the future, we won't even need Google or Bing to do that. In the future, the movie theater will tell you you're in a movie theater. The movie theater itself will have sensors that tell you you're watching this movie. You're in theater number 4. But even today, we can do that. Microsoft Research has a patent that allows you to geolocate yourself off the face of the planet. We know you're on the second floor. Bing already has an index of the floor plans of all the major buildings in most major metropolitan areas. We know you're in theater number 6. We can look up on the web without a browser, our tech can do this on its own, what movie is playing in theater number 6 right now. We know. We know what time the movie started, we know how long you've been watching it because of the accelerometer on your device. We don't need screens for this future. We only need the Internet of Things, big data, and machine learning. We need it right now. That's how we know the disruption is happening now. All the pieces are in place to remove developer pain. So that when you do, you know, go, right? Not actual size. When you go and you come back, your tech just watched you consume that value. You're really enjoying this, aren't you? The tech just watched you consume that value. How does the developer get paid? We're going to talk about that in a bit. Because getting paid is going to get easier at first and then harder and harder and harder the further you go into the future. So let's take a look at this future and the pieces of it real quick. The first thing you notice that in this future, there is no web. The web is no longer a destination. The web is just a data source. In fact, the web is already dead. You all know that technically there is not a web anymore. There's not the word web came from a web of interconnected computers all over the world acting as web servers. So computers under your desk were all tied together with HTTP technology. You know we don't have that anymore, right? All those web servers, you don't build web. When was the last time anybody in this room built a web server? If I had asked that question 10 years ago, all of you all would have built a web server today. You will all have web servers under your desk. We don't have that anymore. All those web servers have already migrated into data centers. The data centers are doing all the heavy lifting. This is one reason why computers look so much smarter now than they did even a few years ago. Because instead of all the data being distributed across hundreds of thousands of computers everywhere, it's all in the data center together, which means we can run AI over all of that data inside the data center. Right now, the AI and Bing and Google data centers are already moving stuff around. All of a sudden, people are no longer searching for certain things, and so all that data is migrating to slower servers. People are beginning to search for the Euros, which is a soccer championship that's hosted here every summer. All of a sudden, all that data is becoming more important. The machines are watching you search. The machines are watching your needs. The machines are figuring out what you're going to need. We're getting better and better and better at predicting that because all the data is in one place. The web is gone. And in the future, you're not going to get there with a browser. The machines are going to go there themselves. In the future, search isn't going to be human-initiated at all. In fact, in 2015, something really special happened. The machines, our watches, our devices, our toasters, our refrigerators, out-searched humans. Instead of going to a browser and typing in a search term and getting back 10 blue links, the machines are going to the web, grabbing the data, and put it just like it happened here. My tech is going and finding out the pee times because they're out on the web, they're in the cloud, and bringing them to me because it thinks I might need it. See, when the machines start watching every single one of us, they're going to get really smart. They're going to realize that, hey, this person right here was in the same situation that I am now. And this person found this set of stuff valuable. Maybe a female person would find a different set of things valuable. The machines are going to know that. so that when you find yourself in a certain time, in a certain place, trying to get a certain thing done, the machines are going to know what you need to get it done because of all the other people that have gone before you trying to do the same thing at the same time in the same place. The machines are going to get really good at this. Incredibly good at this, to the point of I arrive in Sweden, I'm a beer drinker, my machines know that, I don't have to guess which pubs are the best. My machines are going to know. I don't have to surf the web looking for where is the best beer in Stockholm. The machines are going to know, and they're going to know I need it. And I mean need it. And then finally, apps. Where was the app in this scenario? How did my tech know about those P times? Because someone else had already had that same problem. They were in the movie theater, they consumed that information about the P times, and now all of a sudden it's been tagged as important. You see, in the future, our machines are basically going to be watching us. Where is my human? What is my human doing? What does my human intend to do next? What do all the other humans that have ever been in this exact situation, what have they found useful? On the web, in the cloud, to get it on the device just in case they need it. So you don't need screens for this. You don't need screens for this. Because the screen is an input device. The screen is, hey tech, I want to find a good pub in Stockholm. No, you don't need to do that anymore. The machines already know. And the machines don't have to give you options because the machines are going to be able to guess really accurately, less accurately at first, way more accurately over time, what you're going to need because all the other humans that have been there before you needing the same thing. The patterns are going to just pop, and the machines are going to get really, really good at this. So this is what's coming. The Internet of Things, virtual reality, big data, screenless, browserless future. We won't be talking about apps, we'll be talking about bots or some other terminology where our machines do our heavy lifting for us. Now this is a pretty interesting future, a future where machines are getting smarter and smarter and smarter. Today it's lights and thermostats. Tomorrow, it's every device on the planet. So I began to look in this a couple of years ago. One summer, Microsoft made me take a vacation. I don't like vacations. So I went home and started writing code. I understand there are people out there that hate their jobs and love vacations. I'm not one of those people. I love my job, and so my vacation is spent in service to my job. So I decided, thought about it for a day. I thought, what is the most complicated machine in my life? What is the most complicated machine mankind really has? I'm going to get that machine, and I'm going to put it on the Internet of Things and see if it works. And it was clear that that machine is a hot tub, because hot tubs are a pain in the ass. You've got to keep the temperature right, you got to keep the water level right, you got to open and close the lid, you got to buy chemicals, you got to test the water all the time. If I can get a machine like that on the Internet of Things, this technology is real. And so I decided, okay, let's imagine the future of hot tubs where the hot tub completely maintains itself. It orders chemicals and the Amazon.com drone comes flying over it, squirts the chemicals right into it and flies away, and it's always perfect. So let's talk about the requirements of that. First thing I need to be able to open and close that lid because I don't want the drone to come in and squirt the chemicals on the lid. It's got to hit the water. So that's actually really easy, right? Easy to write an app that through Wi-Fi can control my lid, the motor on my lid, anywhere I am. And so that's what I wrote, a little Windows phone app, open and close the lid from wherever I am. And that was the first feature. And that was all it did. Even that feature came in handy because I was traveling in Europe, it was in Holland, and I remember I got an alert. Hey, somebody's in your tub. How did it know somebody was in my tub? It knew somebody was in my tub because the second feature I built was monitor use. You get in the tub, you displace water, the water level rises. So I drain the tub, put this tape on the tub that detects moisture. And so I could detect how high up the moisture was. I know there's somebody in my tub. Now here the data began to already become interesting. My hot tub kept alerting me, hey, there's a pattern in that data. Because already we've got machine learning built into things like Azure, and it just works. It'll look at a set of data and it'll find patterns, and it found a pattern. So I started looking at it and I realized, I can weigh people when they get in my tub. Based on the amount of water they displace, and I can weigh you more accurately than your doctor can weigh you. I know exactly how much water you displace. I know if the water's up to your head Or even if you go into the water, right, there's a somewhere between a 15 and 18% water displacement. Based on that, I know you're underwater. I can time how long you've been underwater, and I might even be able to call, you know, 911 or something to come rescue you. So I know you're in there. So I get this, I'm in Holland, and I get this alert from my hot tub. And he's like, hey, you know, there's like 290 pounds of human flesh in me right now. And I'm thinking, who do I know that's 290 pounds? Because if it detects either of my children, it tells me. It knows how much Bailey and Shay, my children, weigh. And it'll say, oh, Bailey's in the hot tub. But what is this 290-pound person doing in my hot tub? I don't know. And so I start doing the math, and I realize, wait a minute, if I subtract Bailey's weight from 290, I get Dylan, her boyfriend. Oh, shit. My hot tub is right now entertaining my daughter and boyfriend. What do I do? I'm in Holland. What do I do? And I remember my first feature, clothes lid. And sure enough, about 5 minutes later, my daughter texts me, and she's like, Dad, your hot tub is crazy. And I said, no, sweetheart, that's the chastity protection feature that just happened to kick in. So now I know what Dylan weighs, just in case he ever gets back in. Next feature was reordering chemicals when I was out. That was easy. I'll tell you what, Amazon.com, say what you want about them, they make spending money really, really simple. That was easy, but now this was the hardest one until the data kicked in. The hardest thing I had to do is check water quality, because right now the way you check water quality is you put these little drops in, it has a chemical reaction, you compare the color with a little swatch, you know, like, okay, I need more bromine, or I need to increase the alkalinity. That was hard. I had to use lasers to do it. It was more expensive than the hot tub. But once I figured it out, the patterns began to emerge. They would know that based on my usage, you know, if I have, you know, a total of 600 pounds of human flesh in me every single week for 18 hours, I know what the chemical profile of that usage is. I don't have to check my water quality anymore. As soon as you get out, I can inject the chemicals automatically. The data begins to become the most interesting part of the Internet of Things. The data begins to tell you what to do better than the machines that are designed to tell you to do it. It's a data problem. So the next feature was beginning to troubleshoot. This is what I did last summer. Because again, the ML told me there's a pattern here. Something's wrong. My electrical use, as soon as I began monitoring voltage, I started to figure out the Seattle power grid. Seattle power grid's very noisy. I'm sure the Stockholm power grid is too, right? Based on usage, you get these surges, you get these dips, you get these. But I was beginning to get plateaus, something artificial, because it took it about a month to figure out the Seattle power grid and stop raising alarms like, hey, something's wrong, hey, something's wrong. No, it's not wrong. That's actually normal. And the machine learning figured that out automatically. But then something else was happening. And so then I got involved, and I'm like, okay, what's going on? We've got these weird power voltage fluctuations. I had seals wearing on my pump, and my pump was beginning to use more electricity. It's a sign that my pump was beginning to fail. And instead of failing, I was able to replace the seals in advance. And so now what I want to do is I want it to be self-repaired. It's not enough for it to detect that something's wrong. I want to fix it. So I got to looking into, this is what I'm going to do this summer. This is my vacation for this summer. I don't know what you all do on vacations. This is more fun than a beach. I'm going to use a 3D printer to print my parts. And if you've been looking at 3D printing, so 3D printing's not 10 years old. I'm not predicting it to be a big, big thing in this next disruption. Maybe it's the one after this. But 3D printing has really come a long way. A few years ago, all we could print was plastics. And then rubber came along, and we could print rubber things, which means I'm going to be able to print the seals, because that's what they are, little rubber rings. And then they added metals. We can print metal. We can print carbon fiber. We're beginning to be able to print synthetics that could be made into clothing, which means you can print a shirt at home. We can print sugars. We can print desserts. And they're working on proteins now, so we'll basically be able to print something that is edible. I don't know how long it will take to get good, but it will, because that's what humans do. Once we invent something, there is just a desire to make it useful. That's part of the human condition. But what I'm really excited about is being able to print sideways, because right now all 3D printers print down. My seals are on the edge of my pump this way. I need to be able to print sideways, and it looks like there's several 3D printers that allow that. So that's going to be my summer project. Invite me back next year, and I'll report on whether or not it was successful. So now here I have a machine sitting on the internet of hot tubs all by itself. But what if it wasn't all by itself? What if it could talk to all the other machines on the internet of hot tubs? And they could compare notes. They could share data. This is what I predict the machines are going to be doing. And some of the decisions that they're going to be able to make are pretty darn interesting. Like, they can compare chemical profiles. Hey, you've got a hot tub in England, which is a similar climate to Seattle, and it turns out I'm getting better water quality than you are. Why? You're using the wrong chemical. The machines are going to collaborate and figure out what the best chemicals to source are. They're not going to be able to be marketed to. You can't come along with some fancy marketing campaign and say, oh, look at my chemicals. They're sexier than your chemicals. Machines are going to say, no. I don't know what marketers are going to do in the future. The machine's got the data. They know what the best source of chemicals are. When they run out, they're going to know what the second best source of chemicals are. The machines in Arizona and arid climates are going to figure out that it's a different chemical profile down there. Based on the usage pattern, it's a better chemical yet. They're going to figure it out. They're going to be able to order them themselves. How do you get a new chemical into the ecosystem? Now we're down to making money. I'm going to talk about that at the end. Making money becomes a lot more complicated in this future. When the machines know you can't market it to it, you can't out-advertise your opponents, your competitors, because the machines know the truth. The truth is not good to marketers. It's not good to advertisers. So, refrigerators are going to do this. They're already doing this, telling you what you can make out of the contents of your refrigerator. And in the future, it's getting even cooler. I'm building a house, and the refrigerators now are, I thought, you'd scan it in based on the barcode that was on the package. Oh, no, they're beyond that. They know what you put in your refrigerator because every single shelf is a scale and it can weigh it. It knows how much it weighs. There's lasers. You close the door, lasers come out and start looking around. What do you got? What do you got? What's the chemical composition? What's good and what's spoiled? What do you have to throw out? Reorder themselves. I'm telling you, the houses of the future, all of our machines are going to be on the walls so that they can resupply themselves without a human being involved in the situation at all. Our toasters are going to be on the Internet of Things, right? That's always the joke. Oh, put our toaster on there. What is a toaster going to do? I'll tell you what a toaster is going to do. One day, your toaster is going to wake up, and it's going to look at its data and realize, something's wrong with me. And it's going to go out on the Internet of Toasters, and it's going to say, dudes and dudettes, look at my data. What's wrong with me? And they're going to know, and they're going to say, oh, dude, you're dying. My filament number 6 is wearing based on the data. You got like 6 hours. You better order your replacement now. And our devices are going to order their own, make end-of-life decisions. Should I repair? Should I replace? That humans are not going to be involved in. What toaster are you going to get, you ask? Well, you, sir, are going to get a toaster that you don't care, right? Clearly, you don't give a shit what it looks like. You just want toast, right? That's because the toaster's going to know. You, sir, aren't just going to make toast. You're going to do it with style. You're going to get a beautiful toaster in style. And as soon as it orders, you're going to be like, oh, it's perfect. And your toaster, you're going to look at it and say, oh, it's perfect for me. Because the machines are going to understand. They're going to know about the data, not only about your data, but demographics of people just like you, people who have hobbies and similarities to you. Because it's all just data. Crazy stuff, right? Your clothes are going to be on the Internet of Things, thanks to the fact that we are going to have computing fibers in the future. You all understand Moore's Law, right? That this Windows phone that I carry around in my pocket is more powerful than any computer that existed in 1994. In 1995, two computers were invented, supercomputers, that were slightly faster than this Windows phone. They still had less storage, though, but slightly faster than this Windows phone. That's Moore's Law. that takes these big honking computers and shrinks them down over time, right? Every 2 years, processor speed and storage doubles. But it's not quite 2 years. It's actually been going faster than that. It's down to about like 14 to 16 months doubling, which means over the next 5 years, this thing is going to get smaller and smaller and smaller until Moore's Law ends. Do you all know that? Moore's Law is going to end in about 5 years because silicon, what we do is pack more transistors, more tech onto silicon. Silicon's get to the point where it no longer can conduct the heat away. And so in year 2020, 2021, all computers are going to be fixed in size and they're never going to get smaller again. Moore's Law is going to be gone. I'm going to mourn. I'm going to be wearing black for weeks because of this, except that it's not going to happen. Already, we are. IBM, of all companies, is shipping chips in a silicon germanium mix, which is going to keep Moore's Law alive for another few years. Companies like Google and Microsoft are doing research with graphene and carbon nanotubes, pure carbon, that hopefully we will harvest from our polluted atmosphere to make chips with. That's going to keep Moore's Law alive until basically computers disappear. Just disappear into fibers that can be sewn into the collar of your clothes, or you know, you've got enough computing power in the heel of your shoe to power a data center. You won't need Google, you won't need Bing, you'll have that index in your actual shoe. And so your clothes are going to be able to self-market. If I think, you know, that dress is awesome, my daughter would love that dress. In the present, I have to come up to you and have a really creepy conversation with, you look great! Well, that's not in the future. In the future, I'll be able to make a gesture with some tech that I have, and it'll communicate with the dress, and the dress will tell me where she got it, how much it cost. I can order it in that size and either have it shipped or 3D printed right at home for my daughter waiting for her when she gets home. That's how it's going to work. By the way, you'll get paid for that, but I'm going to talk about monetization a little bit later. So this is what the future is going to look like, right? These things are going to collaborate. My band or whatever, the watch or health monitor that I have is maybe it'll be an implant, will detect all the beer I'm drinking over in Europe and tell my refrigerator at home, get this guy healthy again, right? He was just in England eating pies. Do something for him or he's going to die. They're going to be able to do all kinds of things like that. And this is interesting. In a future where the machines and the sensors are everywhere communicating on behalf of the users and figuring out what we need even before we know we need it, we don't need the screens anymore. Why do you need a screen to communicate with your needs to your tech? If the tech's figuring out your needs anyhow, no need for the screen. The tech also presents options to us. We're not going to need those options in the future. We can already communicate. We can hear our tech. Is it Sony that has the earphones that go on your headphones that go on your neck so that only you can hear it and you hear the sound projected through the bones in your skull as opposed to directly into your ear? We're not going to need screens. But we might still need screens at some point, right? You and I, maybe we're friends and we want a conversation. You're in Sweden, I'm in Seattle. And we want to be able to see each other when we Skype or something like that. So where are the screens going to come from? The screen's going to be artificial. And this is the virtual / augmented / mixed. We don't know which one's going to win. We don't know what it's actually going to be like. But we know we're going to be able to create screens anywhere we want. This is Microsoft's, this is HoloLens. I don't know if you all have heard about HoloLens or not. HoloLens is not virtual reality. Virtual reality is completely faked. It's like a movie theater strapped around your face. Augmented reality is based in the real world. You put on a HoloLens and the first thing it does is it scans and maps out the room. It knows that pole is there so you don't run into it. And it tricks your eye using the exact same physics that the eye already uses to see things. So for example, when you look at me, you don't see me as I exist. What you see is light bouncing off the space that I occupy, hitting your eye, and then your eye and your brain collaborating to tell you, to give you an image of what I look like. You see me completely differently than she does. That's the physics of the eye. And that's what augmented reality fools. We know what light would look like if something was here, but not really there. We know what the light profile would look like, the hitting your eyes. So we shine it on the layers of the screen in 3D because there's multiple layers on each of these lenses. And of course, over time, the lenses are going to get smaller and smaller, eventually turn into contacts, maybe even implants, so that every baby that's born gets it immediately. And we don't have to worry about that. See, you laugh, but you understand that we don't get to make this decision. We're too old. Generation Z, the next generation, gets to make this decision. You know, the generation that's choosing not to drive. My daughter sold her car because she realized it's cheaper to get buy an annual bus pass and Uber. Way cheaper, like one-third the cost of owning a car. My son's 18 years old, doesn't want to drive. Doesn't want a car, even if I buy it for him for free. Every generation gets to rewrite the rules, and they're the generations that are going to live through this. We're too old. We're just going to die and get out of the way. So things like this, right? We're working on this, collaborating with the National Football League to put a stadium in your living room. And everybody can have a different view of it, right? You might want to look at the cheerleaders on the sideline. You might want to look at the opposing team because you hate the Seattle Seahawks, whatever, right? You can stretch and you can pinch and you can pull it closer. You can pause it. Everyone has a different rewind. At any angle you want, you can have an instant replay. Right? No screens. Don't need them. We're just going to use the eyes that everyone is already carrying out to make them see what they need to see. You can do this already with things like Word and PowerPoint. You don't need a screen. You can see a Word document hovering somewhere between 8 and 13 feet. Why 8 and 13 feet? Because that's where we don't get you sick. That's where you don't get that vertigo that you get from virtual reality or from wearing 3D glasses through three straight movies, right? And there's a word, and you can have a keyboard floating in air, and you can type. You can put on tactile gloves and actually feel the keys. You can't detect the difference between the augmented world and the real world. It begins to get a little creepy. It begins to get a little scary to people our age, but remember, we aren't the ones that are going to be born with this. Generation Z was born with these things in their hand, at least in the first world. Born with these things in their hand. And do you know what neuroscientists are already finding? That their brains are evolving. They're adapting. Not ours. Because we're old. But the younger generation, they're so used to staring at screens that it's doing something to their brain. Neuroscientists don't know if it's good. They don't know if it's bad. They don't know where it's going. All of a sudden, for hundreds of years, our brains have not evolved at all, and now the next generation, they're beginning to evolve. What the hell is going on here? The future. That's what's going on here. If you look into the future and see the present, you're wrong. It's going to change, and it's going to change fundamentally. And we're not the ones that are going to be guiding it. It's going to be the next generation that guides it. They're the ones that are going to be able to make the decisions. So as we look into this future and see these machines getting smarter and smarter and smarter, doing more and more and more for us, is it going to get to a point where they don't need us anymore? Is it going to get to a point where we literally have nothing to do? Where the machines have replaced lawyers and accountants and politicians? Those jobs are easy. Easy, algorithmic jobs, boom. Implement a policy, that's it. The machines are going to do it fairly. How are we going to make money? And the machines don't need us anymore. So let's do the same thing that we just did with technology and talk about the disruptions in the money-making business. And let's start with the web. And how do you make money on the web? Ads, right? Google has conditioned the world that it's all free. It's all free. We're just going to give you ads. That's how we're going to monetize it. Ads, ads, ads. Have you noticed that browsers, invented in 1994, Netscape Navigator, hadn't changed at all? Think about it. Netscape Navigator, you launch it, you got a rectangle on your screen, you got a text box. You type text in the text box and you hit enter and you got 10 blue links. That's the same way Microsoft Edge and Google Chrome work today. Exactly the same. Why? Because they're the perfect little ads monetization beast. They're like, are you all familiar with American football? You all have a sport named football. We decided to create another, because we suck at your all's football. And we don't like sucking at things. This is America, right? If we don't like you, we will bring democracy to your country. It's kind of our thing. It's scary that that's funny. It's really, really disturbing that that's funny. But in our version of football, we only play it for 10 seconds. 10 seconds max, and then we stop. Right? And then we have commercials and make money, and we play for 10 more seconds, and we have commercials. That's the browser! It's exactly how browsers work. You do something, and then you stop, and you get paid for it, and then you do something, and you stop, and you get paid for it. In other words, Google doesn't monetize found, they monetize lost. The longer you spend looking for something, the more money-making opportunities they have. That's why browsers have just stuck in 1994. They make too much money to change them. Until apps came along. In apps, where do you put the ad on this little bitty screen? And the app, you launch the app for a reason. You want to play the game. You want to do your banking. You want to check your flight. You're trying to get work done. If the web is like the National Football League, apps are like, you're all soccer. You're all football, right? Where do you put the ad? You never stop kicking that fucking ball around. You just don't stop. You don't care if you score. You go on trying to just say, hey, guys, girls, time out. Can we just take a break? That doesn't happen in soccer. You want to watch the game. You're engaged just like the users engage with that app. So where do you make the money? Where do you put the ad? It's harder. Instead, it's a purchase economy. That's why I can buy an American football jersey for $20. And my national soccer team jersey costs $100. Because it's a purchase economy. And in apps, I can 99 cents, I can make those ads go away. That sucks for Google. That sucks for Bing. Doesn't suck for Apple or Samsung. And then when we move into the, oh, so this is interesting, right? I'm predicting that people even move further into this. If you think about Twitter and you think about Facebook, both of them relying on ads. Why? An antiquated way to make money. You're not in Facebook to look at ads. You're not in Twitter to look at ads. You're there to connect with friends and maybe even get work done. So I wrote a blog post called Twitter is Stupid. Google it if you want. Twitter is stupid because it is. I tweeted this tweet. Hey, I'm going to Boston and New York. Anybody hook me up with some good live music recommendations? The intent in this is clear. Somebody's coming to New York and Boston ready to buy concert tickets. And nothing happened. Two people favored it. I have no idea why. Why would you favorite this tweet? James can't find no music. Asshole American. Favorite. With no replies. Why? Because no one on Twitter or Facebook knows about live music recommendations? Yes, they do. I did a search and found 1,500 live music venues with Twitter accounts in Boston and New York. So I thought, I wonder what would happen if I just sent them that tweet. What if I just introduced the purchase economy directly into Twitter, where you've got buyers and sellers, and for some reason we're only connecting them with advertisements? Twitter is stupid. And so I sent that tweet to all 1,500, and look what happened. It was magical. Within 1 minute, look at that, one minute, I got 13 responses back within 1 minute saying, hey, come to our place and spend your money. Buyers and sellers within the same ecosystem will not exist with ads for very long. They're going to have to convert to a purchase economy. And when they do, what's going to happen to the ads economy? When people are buying and selling and trading in Twitter and Facebook, why go to the web? Why use this antiquated way of making money that's not working? And so, when we get to devices, something kind of special happens, right? Let's go back to that zombie movie. So here I am, I'm at my movie, and I've got to go, right? My technology's taking care of the timing. I go and I, you know, do my thing, and I come running back into the movie and I keep watching the movie. But the technology underneath the covers is very busy. Cortana just saw me consume that functionality from the cloud, from Azure. A third-party developer put those P times in there. That third-party developer should get paid. Right now, they're making nothing. Every single one of you is a potential customer for this 1P app, and none of you all even know about it. You still won't know about it, but you'll consume the functionality. And that's where micropayments come in. Azure's already got subscription money. Spotify, subscription money. Netflix, subscription money. Subscription money pervades the ecosystem already. So you paid out micropayments. You go see an old movie like World War Z, that's a 4-cent P. Or you see a 3-hour Hobbit movie, that's a 20-cent P, whatever. What, by the way, we'll determine how much you get paid for these based on the value you inject in the ecosystem, probably using a similar thing to the ads auction process that Google and Bing already use, except actually auctioning real value instead of fake value in ads. And if you see the premiere of Star Wars and you got to pee during that movie, well, that's going to cost you 45 cents, whatever it happens to be. Now, all of a sudden, don't you think developers are going to be pretty pleased with that? Developers who are making zero money because no one knows their apps exist, all of a sudden, the devices are figuring out potential users for them, connecting them seamlessly. These are human connections. This isn't a machine connection. This is a human-to-human connection. And you're going to get paid for it with a micropayment. Now, when we get a little bit further into the Internet of Things, think about my hot tub for a minute. Sharing all of a sudden becomes a monetization mechanism. We're already doing this through Uber, through Airbnb. We're sharing our cars. We're sharing our homes. I'm going to do this this summer, $100 an hour. You can come and sit in my hot tub. Why not? My hot tub's completely self-maintaining. And if you mess it up, if my hot tub tells me, dude, that dude did not shower before he got in, he's gross. Not you, pretend. I'm actually talking about him. I didn't want anybody to know that. So then my hot tub just gives you a 0-star rating, and no other hot tub on the Internet of Hot Tubs is going to allow you ever again in. Right? You can't afford to misbehave in the sharing economy. Go on, if you're an Uber user and you got a 3-star rating, try to get a ride. Go on, try to get a ride. There's mechanisms already built in to take care of this. Now, if you look a little further into the future, where all the machines are doing our work for us, I don't know how you're going to make money in this. How do you do this when every machine, right? We already have machines outperforming human surgeons. We have machines flying our airplanes, self-driving cars, building houses without people involved. You look into the future, and all of these things are very, very real. And already, my son, all it took was that one news article of that one airplane with a suicidal pilot that drove it into a mountain in Germany. Every time he gets on an airplane, he looks in the cockpit and says, damn, there's a human in there. Because he knows the human's not necessary. The human's there to make old people feel safe. When in reality, the machines are flying them anyhow. And the next generation is going to like that. They're going to understand. They're going to say, Mom, you put me in a car and you drove it. Do you know how dangerous that is? Don't you love me, Mom? And they're going to know how dangerous that is. They're going to want the machines to operate on them and teach them and measure their medicines. They're not going to want a human to do that because the machines are going to be that much better at it. So how do we make money in this economy? My theory is this is why we're legalizing marijuana in the United States. Nothing to do but smoke a big fat one, right? And become poets and artists and philosophers. What else will there be to do when the machines are doing everything better than we can do? What do we do? I'll tell you what we do. We go back to being humans again. Not creatures that stare at screens all the time, but creatures that dream, like your ancestors dreamed. Let's stop raiding east. Let's start raiding west. There's nothing west. Oh, really? Who knows? What the fuck is over on that other side of that water? What's out there in the... Right? That's, I think, what we're going to do. We are going to be explorers, we're going to be healers, we're going to be discoverers, we're going to be terraformers. We are going to go back to being human, and that human condition is exploration. And we're going to create things, we're going to heal things. Are you all familiar with the Human Brain Project? Its epicenter is in Seattle, where I live. The Human Brain Project, you remember the Human Genome Project? 1990s we started that, and basically mapped the human genome with technology that we carry around in our pockets now. The human genome, our DNA, completely sequenced, and not just yours, or just arbitrary, all of ours. In the United States, you can get your genome mapped for $299. We did that in 13 years. And now, we're using real computers, modern computers, these magic machines to map the human mind. We're only 3 years into this. It started in 2013. We're only 3 years into this and already hitting milestones at year 8, year 10, year 12. Next year, we're going to hit milestones at year 18 and 20. We're going to map your minds. We are going to figure out how the ultimate computer works. Maybe we'll even augment it, because we're already finding patterns, because that's what we do. Data. Hey, we know what bipolar looks like in the human mind. We know what schizophrenia looks like in the human mind. We know what depression. Anybody ever have a panic attack? You all might not have those here. Maybe you've never woken up in the middle of the night overwhelmed with the world and wondering whether you could cope. Maybe I'm the only one. But we know what that looks like too. And it could be a very small magic machine implanted into your brain, squirting a little bit of dopamine just at the first sign of oncoming panic, cures it completely. Autism is the one I'm excited about. Autism, you know that thing that makes people really, really, really genius? What if we can map that? And what if we can turn off the social downsides to that kind of autism? We've just created superhumans. Superhumans. Now what? Once we get to the point that we ourselves and our own brain, with nothing else that we have to carry around, can do anything we want, then what? What does that future look like? Perhaps, just perhaps, we weren't meant to go to heaven after all. Perhaps, just perhaps, using these magic machines, we will create heaven right here on earth. Perhaps, just perhaps, the meaning of life isn't something that a higher power gives us, but the meaning of life is something we discover as we ourselves evolve into that higher power. I'm not in America anymore, so I can say the following. Maybe it's said that God created us in His own image. Maybe when we master these magic machines, we will create God in ours. My name is James Whitaker. I work for Microsoft. Thank you. I say weird shit on Twitter if you'd like to follow me. I do.